National Longshore and Warehouse Union
has a long, proud history of rank-and-file democracy and bottom-up union, which means that all the officers in the union come from the rank-and-file and were elected from the rank-and-file. And we have rich traditions of international solidarity. Local 37 was no different, but each local within the ILWU also has its own culture and its own traditions as well. And local autonomy from the international is something that's very valued in our union. The international doesn't run our locals. The locals are all run by the officers that were elected in that local. And so over the years, Local 37 was somewhat removed from the international for numerous reasons. But by the 60s and 70s, some of it really had to do with what Ligaya was talking about, which was more the corruption within the local. At the same time, the demographics in the union were also changing, with second-generation Filipinos working in the industry, and the hiring of many college students. As Ligaya said, Filipinos had been the main workforce in the canneries since the late 1920s, and that was changing. At the same time, jobs in the canneries, as Ligaya mentioned, they were very racially segregated. So the jobs that were the machinists or the mechanics or anyone who were had more skilled jobs or higher paying jobs were mainly white workers, white men. And so that continued to be racially segregated, as well as the living conditions. So there were still Filipino bunkhouses, the native Alaskan bunkhouses, and the women were also segregated and separated. And those other bunkhouses were off limits to the workers of color, as well as the eating facilities. So they were still, when I was there in the 70s, they were still very much like that. Everyone ate in their own mess halls. And the food conditions, as Ligaya said, they weren't quite that bad when I was there, but they still were very different depending on which mess hall you ate in. Selmy Domingo and his brother Nemesio and Gene Viernes and many other young second-generation Filipinos who worked in the canneries during that time were also college-educated. And they put those skills to work to take up the discrimination and the disparity that they found working in the Alaska seafood industry. Their experiences when they were there moved them to create change. First thing, of course, you would do as a worker is to go to your union leadership and say, there's something wrong, this isn't working, and file a grievance. Or talk to your officers about grievances, about how to create change. Unfortunately, that fell on deaf ears when they went to their union leadership. They refused to act on any of the issues that were being raised, particularly around racial discrimination, or in that regard, mostly about anything. So in 1974, Selmy Domingo and his brother and others filed class action, Title VII class action lawsuits against two of the most powerful companies in the Alaska seafood industry, charging overt racial discrimination in the segregation of jobs, housing, and mess halls as a means to change the working conditions in the industry and to open up job opportunities in the industry to a non-white workforce, and also to put pressure on the union to end the sweetheart relationship that they had had with the company bosses. So there was also another dimension going on here, which was not only were they not taking up grievances, but when it came to collectively bargaining, they also were not putting full force of the union at the bargaining table. So in a lot of ways, and there was a lot of relationships with the officers and some of the companies where some records show talks about here's your sugar money. And you can read that in any way. But back then, the way we read it to be was that they were being paid off by the company, by the industry, not to take on what the issues were, not only in terms of the discrimination or the conditions at the canneries, but also not to improve the contracts and to keep the wages low. But as our legal system goes, The lawsuits were filed, and it took many, many, many years to work their way through the courts. We didn't have time to wait for conditions to change or to change conditions, to wait to see what the courts were going to rule. And again, you never know how they're going to rule or if they're going to rule. So that we realized then that really the only way to create change was to take it on ourselves. And for us, that meant taking on the leadership in the union. If we were going to really create change, we were going to have to do that. But because Jean and Selmy had filed the lawsuits against the companies retaliated against them and refused to rehire them. And again, the union also went along with that and refused to dispatch them. So how it worked was, the contract was, if you had worked in a cannery the previous year, you had the first right to be hired next year. If you had worked for that company at a different plant, you had the second right. Well, we call that second preference to be hired to that company. And then thirdly, if you had worked in the industry at all, then you got the next chance. If there was an opening, you got the next chance to be hired. In this case, the union dispatchers refused to hire them even at the third level, even though they had the experience and they could have gone to another company cannery. They refused to hire them at all. And that happened to many of the plaintiffs of the lawsuits. So, using the lessons from an earlier reform movement in our union, and we were fortunate at that time that a lot of what we call the monongs in the canneries at that time had also a very rich history of forming the union, and also they had had earlier reforms. Excuse me. So we, you know, talked to them and learned from them and learned the lessons that they had done and used some of their same experiences to build on that and to build a reform movement within the union. We organized what we called a rank and file committee to start to implement reforms within the union. These reforms really consisted of some very simple basic things like, you know, the union should be engaged in shop steward training. We should take up the safety issues of the canneries, because at that time the canneries were still, they used very old machinery, the machinery that had been built at the turn of the century and was very unsafe. In some cases, it didn't have simple safeguards where people could, you know, lose their fingers, their hands. And there were accidents that happened. So taking on just simple things like safety issues, communication to the members, because in the off-season, people go away, and they lived, as Ligaya said, they still migrated, a lot of them, and worked in the fields in California and then only came up in the summer to work in the canneries. So communication to the members, even during the season, was important. And certainly grievance handling and organizing, because the union had been losing plants all across Alaska. And most importantly, a fair dispatch system, because the dispatch system, as I explained how it should have been, there was also room in there for bribery. And a lot of times it was who knew the dispatcher and how much money you paid him or the president is what got you a job. And thirdly, another very important thing to us was fair elections within the local so that we could run for office. And getting other rank and file members dispatched to Alaska then became important to us in order to build the movement. Because Jean and Selmy and some of the leaders couldn't go, it meant, more importantly, that we get other activist types to Alaska. Through legal pressure, though, we were able to get Jean and Selmy reinstated into the union and to get dispatched to work and to once again be able to go back to Alaska. The rank-and-file movement then grew, with us sending representation to every plant and electing shop stewards and taking up the workers' issues on the shop floor, thus gaining the respect and support from the members. We then ran a rank-and-file committee members to run for union office in 1978, winning several of the positions on the executive board, and in 1980, when the secretary-treasurer of the local died, we were able to get Selmy Domingo appointed to finish out the term of office. Later that year, we swept the union elections with rank-and-file committee members, taking every position in the local except for the president, whom we didn't run against. And in retrospect, that was a mistake. Selmy was then elected to the secretary-treasurer position and Jean Viernes to the dispatcher position, and myself and others to the executive board. We had only begun to implement our reform program when they were gunned down in the Union Hall after the very first fair dispatch of the season. Being that many of us were also political activists, we brought many of those issues to the membership as well, and given that the majority of the membership were Filipino, the political situation in the Philippines was a common debate. The ILWU has a long history of supporting trade union rights abroad and opposition to U.S. support of foreign dictatorships. Selmy and Jean were part of that history. They brought their fight for workers' democratic rights in the Philippines under the Marcos regime to the ILWU International Convention. And they were building solidarity with the labor movement in the Philippines at the same time. They were both outspoken anti-Marcos activists and members of the KDP, a political organization that was opposed to martial law in the Philippines. They were killed shortly after returning from the ILWU International Convention in Hawaii, where we introduced a resolution to send an ILWU delegation to investigate the conditions and the struggle of workers and unions in the Philippines. This action was a direct threat to the Marcos dictatorship because the labor movement was the one area that he had little support because of his brutal attacks on labor and because of the no-strike decree that he had created that was part of his regime. The support of the ILWU for the KMU, which was the largest trade union federation in the Philippines, had just been sealed. And any disruption of cargo into or out of the Philippines would have major economic impact on the country. The killing of trade unionists in this country was really something that happened in the 30s and 40s, and I'm sure most of you are thinking that and this happened not in your lifetime even. And so even for us, it was quite shocking. Usually, that happened when there was some kind of major dispute, like some big strike or something major happening within the union and the employer, or something, something that really you would understand that maybe something like that could happen, but not for political reasons, not here. We were stunned and not sure how to respond, or trying to figure out who was behind it. Was it the industry? Was it the gangsters in the local? Was it the union president that was so threatened by us? Was it our government or the Marcos dictatorship or all of the above? And Sydney's going to cover some of that. Immediately after the murders, the rank-and-file committee regrouped and strategized what would be our response. Would we, should we walk away? Or should we step back in the union and take the positions and continue the work that Jean and Selmy and the rank and file committee had started? Because of the leadership that Jean and Selmy had provided, they had trained us well, they had created a plan for us to continue to implement the reforms, and we weren't going to let their lives be in vain. And in fact, we got back into the union immediately, the days preceding to the death, and continued the work. The president of the union was found to be involved in the murders. It took us years to prove that, but we got him ousted. And in 1983, I became the president of the local, and then the rank and file committee did, in fact, hold every office in the union and implemented every reform that we had fought so hard to gain. The union has gone through many changes in the last 30 years. In 1987, we merged the ILWU Local 37 into the Inland Boatmen's Union and became Region 37. The Inland Boatmen's Union is the Marine Division of the ILWU. Since that time, the companies that have the discrimination lawsuits have gone out of business, or in the case of Ward's Cove, it was sold, and most of those plants have since closed. The one remaining employer is Peter Pan Seafoods, which was never a part of the lawsuits and had a very different policy on how they treated workers, and we continue to have a union contract and continue to have about 1,000 members working in the industry. The industry, too, has gone through many changes in the last 30 years, moving away from canning to mostly processing fresh, frozen product, which is of less labor-intensive and is mostly sold on the foreign market. The industry is also challenged by the competition of farm-raised fish, so it's had a big impact on it as well. But we maintain and remain a strong rank-and-file union that fights for workers' rights both on the job and internationally. Thank you.
So I want to say this is actually the first time that the three of us have ever presented together.
It's, and I thank Professor Gregory for giving us that opportunity on this 30th anniversary of Salmi and Jean's death. It certainly does not feel like 30 years, it's an honor to see his daughter take up the banner, my niece, to take up the banner of the work that her father so valiantly gave his life for. And I want to kind of humanize not only our struggle, but also who Salmi and Jean were. Salmi and Jean really, and all of us, were not much older than you all are now when their murders happened. So they were only 29 years old. I was only 28. Terry was about the same age. And as Jim said, the guy was only 4 years old. So if you can imagine, in 5 years, you were battling some very powerful interests. You're trying to take over a union. You were faced with two murders. You were battling a dictatorship, and you were battling against your own U.S. government, who has protected the murderers, but also surveilled and violated your democratic rights to oppose a dictatorship abroad and to organize your own people. There are some very powerful interests that intervene in Salmi and Jean's death, not only before, during, and after the murders, but also a very powerful movement that we think we built and represents a power that people in this country very often do not realize that they can have, especially when they are confronted with such powerful interests from abroad and again and within our own government. We were only students like all of you at the time when we first became active. But we were also a product of our political period in which we became political activists, somewhat, very different from what you all are experiencing. So when we formed the Union of Democratic Filipinos, the KDP, it was a very different political period in which we really thought, and people laugh about it now, but we really felt, much similar to what was happening in the Middle East in terms of the powerful movements that toppled governments in Egypt and all the other countries surrounding, which are challenging those repressive governments now. We also felt that power here in this country as young people. There were revolutions happening in Africa and Central America and Latin America and Asia. The Vietnam War ended with a victory for the Vietnamese people. Guinea-Bissau, South African people were rising up against apartheid. In Central America, there were revolutionary movements in El Salvador, Nicaragua, 1979, the Sandinistas took power. So for us, it was a very exciting political period. And so when you think about what people were doing there, we were supporting governments who were winning, the people were winning power, controlling the destiny of their own lives, as well as studying about Marxism, Leninism, the revolutions of the early 1900s, what was happening in China in terms of Mao Zedong thought. And so for us, it was very, very empowering. And then given what we had experienced through our own parents' experiences, we wanted a better life than what they had, and even better than what they had given us through their own sacrifices. My father came here to this country and worked as a farm worker. He went and picked asparagus in Yakima, picked strawberries down in California, then went to Alaska working in the canneries and living in Chinatown in rooms that had no bathrooms, shared bathrooms and shared kitchens. He traveled, you know, at different points he was making, you know, 10 cents an hour maybe when he had come to this country thinking he was going to become, you know, go to school. He barely finished high school and then was inducted into the U.S. Army, became a citizen and a member of the U.S. Army at the same time, really against his wishes. He didn't come to this country to go fight a war in the Philippines. So, you know, I want to say that because we were the product of our political times, but we really were no different from studying, trying to get our degrees. Took us a little more time. I didn't get my degree, so because we got wrapped up into political work. And so we weren't extraordinary people. We were just like you. But I think eventually we made extraordinary choices that we were going to not let those powerful voices silence us or silence the movement that we created over the years before and after Salmi and Jean's death. So the Union of Democratic Filipinos, the KDP, was representative of a political movement that we began with a working class movement that was built in the Philippines called the Katipunan, meaning the Union. It was led by Bonifacio, and it represented the working class's response to U.S. imperialism at the turn of the century. We studied that movement, and we decided that we were going to be the working class movement in the Filipino community in the 1970s. We had big vision, and that's what those powerful revolutionary movements made us feel, that we could build those kind of political movements to challenge especially the dictatorship in the Philippines and challenge our U.S. government's support for that dictatorship. The 1980s, we saw our U.S. government support a number of dictatorships around the world, and their support for Ferdinand Marcos was no different. What was different about the Philippines was that the U.S. had strategic interests there. They had two military bases, Subic Naval Base, and Subic and another Air Force base, which name escapes me right now, in which planes flew in. They were able to use those two bases as a way to project U.S. military force throughout Asia and the Pacific. Those bases were key to U.S. military strategy during especially the Vietnam War. So we in the KDP, who really never numbered more than 300 people across the United States, although people thought we were many more, could have sworn there were thousands of us in those cities, formed various chapters across the United Nations in the cities that had major Filipino communities. New York, Washington, D.C., Seattle, the Bay Area, Oakland, San Francisco. We had two chapters there, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Hawaii, and even one in Guam. We decided that we would essentially have two goals, two missions. One, to politicize the Filipino community here in the United States, which at the time was fairly small, probably didn't number more than 500,000 Filipinos at the time, but was beginning to grow because of the change in immigration laws. That we were going to politicize our community and work for essentially socialism, socialist ideals within the community, and struggle and take up the struggles around discrimination. Our second task was to support the revolutionary movement in the Philippines that was at that time being led by the National Democratic Front through an armed struggle led by the New People's Army. So it was a fairly radical platform that the KDP was founded. Majority of people, they were both in terms of Filipino Americans, like my generation, born here in the United States, the majority of us never even being to the Philippines, and Filipino nationals whose families were fleeing the dictatorship or coming as a result of a change in immigration, coming to the United States to build a better life for themselves. It was these two sectors of young people, mainly, who came together to form the KDP in 1973. So they came with very different experiences, political experiences, as well as personal experiences, but came together with those two goals in mind in terms of building a movement to support the radical movement in the Philippines towards democratization and radicalizing the Filipino community here in this country. We were very open in terms of who we supported in the Philippines and what our program was. So even though the Filipino community at the time was a fairly small community, we think that the development of the KDP itself, especially with our connections with the radical movement led by the New People's Army, Communist Party of the Philippines, National Democratic Front in the Philippines, the relationships of these movements caused, and given the strategic interests in the Philippines that were at stake, caused the U.S. government's intelligence agencies to take note of our movement here in the United States. And it wouldn't have been the first time they took note. As Terry said, we learned in the Union Local 37 struggle, the mentors of our movement in that sector were members, Filipino members of the Communist Party in the United States. Again, people who were of very radical thought, people who had made a direct relationship to the movement back home, the radical movement back in the Philippines. And so our thinking is now that it didn't take much for the FBI or other intelligence agencies in the United States to take note that a new radical organization was developing with the program of trying to stop U.S. support of the Marcos dictatorship and building a more radical movement here in the United States amongst the Filipino community. We know that through Freedom of Information Act documents that our government was spying on the activities of the KDP. They spied on the activities of the former leaders of the Local 37. They spied on Carlos Bulacan, whose book you have read. So that it's no doubt that they were surveilling and infiltrating the KDP from the very beginning that the KDP was formed back in 1973 and 1974. So they saw it as a the government agencies saw the KDP's work as a continuum
of some of the work that was begun in Local 37 back in the 30s and 40s. And when Salmi and Jean and the reform movement in Local 37 went to that conference in Hawaii that Terry was talking about to begin to look at the labor conditions in the Philippines, not only did the Marcos dictatorship take note, but also the U.S. intelligence agencies took note, our government took note, was that activity going to be allowed any longer within the Filipino community. The KDP, as I said, the KDP was never, in the thousands, but yet the work that they did and the many campaigns and issues that the KDP took up nationwide and locally were fairly significant in nature. The KDP led the fight to change the laws and the regulations governing the licensing of foreign doctors and nurses in this country. They organized the nurses and doctors to take a position, to take stands, to take public stances to oppose the discrimination policies that prohibit them from becoming nurses and doctors here in this country. Some of you may have heard about the housing struggles in the International Hotel in San Francisco, where the KDP activists played a key role in preserving housing, both in the San Francisco area, but also here in the International District in Seattle, as well as other anti-discrimination issues regarding people who worked in the embassies who were oftentimes essentially indentured servants and freeing them from their conditions that they were facing in working for families in the embassies. So it was the KDP had a in-your-face, essentially, work ethic. They were not going to stand down while they saw unjust conditions or people facing larger bodies of Filipinos facing discriminatory conditions. And that's one of the reasons, big reasons, that Salmi and Jean and others went into Local 37 to fight not only for better working conditions for their fathers who were still working in the canneries, but for a whole new generation of cannery workers, including themselves. So the KDP obviously led in the fight after Salmi and Jean's death. But we also knew that we could not do it alone. The whole murder of Salmi and Jean and what transpires after their death is almost like a mystery movie, right? With different intelligence agencies involved, different trials occurring. So within the year of Salmi and Jean's murder, we had already had two murder trials in which the gang that was involved, that was actually hired to carry out the murders, those gang members were put in prison for life. The President of the Union, as Terry said, was eventually, 10 years after the murders, finally found guilty in the murders. And then there are all the elements of a spy thriller, I guess, murder. I guess we didn't have a whole bunch of sex, so we couldn't throw that in the mix. or any stories that we're willing to tell. But it really is, as Terry says, it's not like it's something that you would think would happen to ordinary people who were just organizing to make things better in their own communities. But yet, as I said, We were challenging some very powerful interests at the time that Salmi and Jean died. So
You know, in terms of the murder conspiracy, I do want to say that we knew our community so well. We knew within 24 hours who we were able to figure out pretty much the murder conspiracy and who was involved. We asked the question, who benefited from Salmi and Jean's murders? And from our knowledge of the Union, from our knowledge of the Marcos dictatorship, and the knowledge of what Salmi and Jean and the reform movement were doing at the times, we figured out four areas of interest. The Tulisan gang, who carried out the murders, and who within 24 hours, two of the members of that gang were picked up, the actual hitmen. U.S. government interests, so that we did raise. The U.S. government had to be involved in this somehow. We didn't quite know because we weren't, you know, we hadn't quite figured out how they were intervening in the murders at this point of time, nor did we realize what was coming down the pike in the years to come. The Philippine government, the Marcos dictatorship, who obviously benefited because they thought they were going to stop the work that Salmi and Jean were doing in relationship to sending a labor investigating team to the Philippines to investigate labor conditions in the Philippines. And then there were the powerful interests of the owners of the company, of the cannery companies. So those were the four interests that we knew had some role in Salmi and Jean's death. Now, we knew that the cannery owners probably were not directly involved, but they didn't shed a tear because they thought with Salmi and Jean's death that that would be the end of the reform movement. And Terry has told you how that did not occur. But with the Tulisan gang, in the year after Salmi and Jean died, the Tulisan gang members were put in prison. The two hitmen who were probably paid, the Tulisan gang, we think were paid $5,000 to carry out the murder by the president. And then the head of the gang who was trying to implicate the president at the time of when he was picked up for the murder. So within a year, we had all three of those people in prison, tried, proven by a jury, in front of a jury, and committed to life in prison without parole. So they all three are, I think, at Walla Walla still. But what was telling, which again told us that we were on the right track, was the trial of the head of the gang who said, I know who's behind this murder, but I can't tell you. I'm going to go to life in prison, but I cannot tell you who is responsible for this. He was covering up for the president of the union because he had family in the Philippines and did not want to expose his family to the power of that dictatorship. A year later, in 1982, when Marcos came for a state visit, we were able to file a civil suit charging the Marcos regime with the murders of Salmi and Jean, and a class action lawsuit charging that the Marcos government, in complicity with the U.S. government, had harassed, surveilled, and ultimately were responsible for Salmi and Jean's death. It was a landmark case, which we eventually won in 1989, December of 1989, after a three-week trial in federal court. Again, another landmark lawsuit that we won after eight years of struggle. 8 years of people not believing, many people not believing that these murders were what we said they were, and exposing not only the way in which the Marcos government, through a corporation, paid for the murders in the United States. We found an actual document. Marcos came to this country in 1986. He came to Hawaii, fleeing People's Power in the Philippines, and came to this country with boxes of documents, jewelry, and whatever, with his entourage, like so many other dictators do. And within those boxes of documents was one document that was found by an ex-CIA-trained Philippine operative, and it was called the Mabuhay Corporation document, which had the dates that we knew that the money was paid for the murders. $15,000, in which the president of the union on May 14th traveled in one day down to San Francisco, went to get the money that was dispersed on that document, and came back up here to Seattle, and the following week was seen having meetings with the Tulisan gang to carry out the murder. And at the bottom of that was a signed statement by the owner of that corporation saying to Tony Barroso, I pay you $15,000. So that document showed that we knew where the payment was coming from. We also were able to get documents that were secretly discussed in Congress. It was called the Philippine Infiltration Plan, in which our government knew that the Marcos dictatorship was sending agents into this country to surveil and intelligence language says to surveil and move against the U.S.-based anti-Marcos movement. And move against means use physical violence. Our government knew and was cooperating with those agents as they were coming into the country. Those agents were named in those documents. We also know through private investigators that there was misinformation that Gene was carrying large sums of money to the Philippines when he went in May. Now, the KDP used to raise money through Christmas caroling, through selling newspapers, and so we weren't raising a whole lot of money to send to the Philippines. If anything, it was $200, $300, $400, $500, but certainly not at the level of $150,000, in which our U.S. government probably gave and allowed misinformation that Gene was carrying large sums of money like that, with knowing that the Marcos dictatorship would take note that this man is carrying a huge sums of money, which will go to the New People's Army to buy weapons to fight against the Marcos dictatorship. So the U.S. government allowed that misinformation to go on, which probably eventually caused Gene's death. We think that, I just want to close that we built the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Varinas and sustained it for almost 10 years. And although we fought a court case, it was really that movement that helped to keep Salmi and Jean's name alive, helped to build an extensive movement that reached not only here in the United States to congressional members, to city council members, but also in the Philippines, so that when Cory Aquino was elected, she announced that there were three human rights cases that she was going to pursue. One was the assassination of her husband. The other was the assassination and disappearance of a well-known Philippine journalist who left the United States on a plane and was never seen again. And the third one was Salmi and Jean's death. And that was because we had built the movement around the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Varinas. Many of us have gone on to do many more things after winning Salmi and Jean's case. But I know that of all the work that we've done, that this working on Salmi and Jean's case was not only a personal victory, but it was a victory for the people that had become part of that movement. It was an honor to work
on behalf of Salmi and Jean's name. And it's an honor to continue to talk about the work they did, as well as the work that we all did to get justice in their name. Thanks.
Thank you. This was an incredible story about labor movements, transnational effects, unions that work across oceans and across boundaries, and about activism, determined activism, over years and years and years, that brings about really important historic results. So I know people want to ask questions, and we have this very awkward physical space, but maybe sitting as you are, or possibly swinging around a little bit. Ask a question of anyone here. There are details to be filled in. There's certainly lots of implications of this incredible story that we could talk about.
I just have a question about whether Salmi and Jean, the extent to which your communicated that Salmi and Jean were actually in physical danger from the various forces working against them.
Actually, we didn't. I mean, I think there was some sense from Gene's trip to the Philippines, because when he came back, he met us, and Cindy was with us in Hawaii when we went for the international convention, and Gene met us in Hawaii returning from the Philippines, and he was very uncomfortable and told us that he knew he was being surveilled and watched when he was there and being followed. So that really was sort of the first real implication to us that, you know, from the Philippine side that we were being observed. And he also, when we came back then to Seattle, Gene used to like to run all the time. And he started to tell us that he knew he was being followed. And so, you know, our guard came up. And certainly within the union, there had been threats, but it was not at that kind of level. It was more from some of the gangsters that we knew we were threatening a certain, I think as Ligaya said, that there was gambling going on in the canneries, and there still was, and that was very prevalent. And by us taking on the dispatch system, we knew that then we were cutting into their bribes and money that they were making. So we knew, too, that was a possibility, but I don't think we thought of it and really in those terms of being killed over it. But
talk a little bit about the dispatch that had just happened and the tension that you felt there.
So as I mentioned in my presentation, that they were killed the day of the first dispatch. So we too work very collectively in the union with the reform movement, and a number of us were KDP activists as well. And so we certainly strategized our plans and talked about them. And the one area that we did have disagreement, even amongst ourselves, was the dispatch and how to implement it. And if we implemented it too soon without the proper communication with the membership and support from them about how it would be implemented, that there could be pushback. So we had disagreement amongst ourselves, and I think certainly the day of the dispatch, it was after the dispatch, some of them came in to Gene and were complaining about the way the dispatch had gone, because we stopped. We only did it, as I explained, how you had the first, second, and third. We were very strict about that. If you didn't meet that criteria, you didn't get to go unless all those other people had been filled. And they were trying to slip some people in. The president was trying to slip people in, and Gene prevented it from happening. And so after the dispatch, they came into the office and started screaming at him and telling him Viernes would be Sabado tomorrow. And so there was some sense then that either that was being used as a way to make it look like it was over that, and I think as Cindy said, that's why the gangsters and some of that was made to look like that's all it was about. But
Yeah, I think at the convention, actually, the one of the pictures that Jim showed up there was Gene standing at the podium presenting the resolution on the Philippines. And, I mean, I was there, but, I was having a good time, right? I was hanging at the beach and having drinks and this picture here. And Gene came up to me and said, I'm going to give you $1. Can you buy that picture? I said, well, what do I want that picture for, you know? And he says, I'm afraid that some agent is going to buy a picture. But, you know, it didn't occur to us that while he was afraid, they had not had their debriefing yet in San Francisco. About a week before they died, both Salmi and Gene came down to San Francisco to be debriefed by our national headquarters about Gene's trip to the Philippines and the strategy that they were taking around the Union. But Gene already knew from being in the Philippines that he was being surveilled. And yet it came too soon. You know, if probably they had gone to the Bay Area, if the murders had happened later and there was more discussion within the national headquarters, especially with people from the Philippines who knew better the nature of the Marcos dictatorship and had put the pieces together about what the real nature of the work we were doing and what interests we were really threatening, we may have had a better inkling that we were really in danger, that Salmi and Gene were in real danger, especially Gene, because he'd been surveilled in the Philippines. But, you know, like a lot of young people, we were very naive about the interests that we were challenging. You know, and then personally, for the leadership in the KDP, I mean, there's a very personal side to us, to this also, in terms of, you know, if you think about it, the day they were murdered, David Della had to go in and identify Gene's body. Very difficult thing when you're, you know, like in your 20s. And for those people in the leadership of the KDP who helped design the strategy of the Local 37 work and how they were going to move, how they were going to use that work to challenge interests in the Philippines of the Marcos dictatorship, you know, there was a lot of guilt and thinking, how could we have been so naive to think that the Marcos dictatorship would not come to the United States and stop our movement from threatening those interests. And as the years went by and we uncovered more and more information and now getting more FBI documents showing the level of surveillance of KDP people and our work, we realized much more than we ever thought that we were doing work that really was having a very powerful impact in terms of U.S. interests in the Philippines.
How do you think other organizations and groups in Seattle learned from you? And what other movements were inspired by your diligence, your activism, and your success? What happened?
Well, you know, I think after Salmi and Gene died, we were a pretty sophisticated movement in terms of looking at how broad we could build the support movement of the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Varinas. Immediately after they were murdered, we did a call for justice in which we went to city council members, the mayor, to sign this call for justice and other community leaders, not only in the Filipino community, but movements in the Black community and other labor leaders. So we tried to make it as broad as we could. When we did the Committee for Justice, we had a core of about 80 people working every day in that first year to get justice for Salmi and Gene. We had 8 outreach committees, reaching out to women's community, gay, lesbian community, Black community, anti-racist community, Filipino community, etc. So we went as broad as we could. Anyone that would support our basic call to get the murderers of Salmi and Gene, we brought them together. We had a meeting every week for, you know, probably throughout the year, especially during the murder trials, to inform the public of what was happening. We work with the prosecutors to build their case. Without us, there would be no criminal case. And so many radical movements didn't want to work with the prosecutor because they had determined they were part of the government structure that oppresses working class people and communities of color. But we knew that we didn't have the power to criminally prosecute those people and to put them in prison. Part of it was important. It was important to protect especially those people who were working in the union, because if you didn't get the gangsters off the street, those people were always going to be threatened. They were thugs. They were carrying guns. Local 37 decided that they were going to enclose themselves behind glass to protect themselves from bullets. Now, it was kind of a facade because it was not bulletproof glass.
It was really thick.
It was really thick plastic, right? But I mean, those are the kinds of things that you not only had to protect the people that were doing the work, but you had to do the criminal prosecution. You had to defend what you were saying, what this case was about, as well as trying to work with private investigators that had connections with intelligence operatives so that they could find out what the real story about Salma and Jean's murder was about. So I think we, given the times that we were working in, we were pretty sophisticated and willing to work with, congressional people who could give us the Philippine infiltration plan and other documents that proved, you know, that what we were saying was true. So, you know, and I think we did have an influence in people because it showed this movement had radical politics, talking about socialism, talking about communism, espoused to be Marxist-Leninist, but we were willing to work with prosecutors, news people, the New York Times, who wrote editorials for us, Washington Post, go to Congress to meet with congressional people who really sometimes, I remember I went to go meet with the chair of the Foreign Relations Bill, Senate Foreign Relations. He says, well, I'd like to help you, but can you come back when you have something a little more serious happens?
Yeah.
You know. The murder of my brother is not serious enough. But then to keep going back to congressional people and say, we need your help. You guys are supporting a dictatorship who just murdered two U.S. citizens. So, you know, it really took an array of tools and working with different people who along the way dropped off, because once you start threatening again, strategic interests start implicating and start raising national security issues are protecting murderers, then they say, well, we don't want to go there, right? But so, you know, and through the different forums we did and symposiums, we worked with the Chilean movement here that were Chilean activists who were also living in exile because of their work against the Pinochet dictatorship that overthrew the democratic elected Allende government. We work with the Palestinian movement, members of the Palestinian movement who are being deported because of their work here in this country. We work with the Vietnamese movement of Vietnamese people who were being harassed as well in their own community. So we worked with an array of different movements in the United States and abroad. And, you know, that's why when you talk about not only a local movement, national movement, but as well as international movement.
Thank you very much for today and for everything you've done for the last 30 years.